This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, once again, we'll hear about how the FBI is applying intense pressure to turn individuals into informants.
Work with us, the federal spooks say, or we'll deport you.
Our own Michael Smith draws a balance sheet on the state of democratic rights in America. He spoke to a captive audience at the long-standing Five Towns Forum on Long Island in honor of recently deceased Center for Constitutional Rights Vice President Bob Boehm. We'll talk to attorney Len Weinglass about the resentencing of Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five.
Despite an agreement between the U.S. attorney and Lenny Weinglass, Guerrero's attorney, the judge went above the agreement and gave Guerrero an additional 2 years tacked onto his 20-year sentence.
Stay with us. Michael, we just read that a top U.S. official in Afghanistan has resigned his post in protest of the war. What do you think about this?
Well, the guy's Matthew Ho. He was a Marine captain in Afghanistan. Then he was a Foreign Service officer over there, and he quit. And he says, this is the reason he gives for quitting. I have lost understanding of and confidence in the strategic purposes of the United States' presence in Afghanistan. And then he says, and he wants to make a big deal about this. I want people in Iowa, people in Arkansas, people in Arizona to call their congressman and say, listen, I don't think this is right. Well, this is really interesting, I think, because he was one of their top policymakers.
Even though he's only 36.
Yeah, but they gave him a big job because they wanted to co-opt him. They didn't want him to come out and complain. And he said, I realized the implications for my career, but he still quit. And this is not a particularly nice guy. He says, I'm not some peacenik, not a pot-smoking hippie who wants everybody to be in love. And then he says, there are plenty of dudes who need to be killed, he said about al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I was never more happy than when our Iraq team whacked a bunch of their guys. So this is interesting because this guy is a warrior, and he's quitting. He doesn't know why the American troops are over there. He's demoralized, and he's going public. And the thing that was interesting to me, Heidi, was that when this started happening in Vietnam, I remember when one of the top colonels in Vietnam quit and came out publicly against the war in Vietnam, and we all said to each other, you know, this is the beginning of the end, and it was. Well, I don't know whether this is the beginning of the end, but it's really interesting.
It is noteworthy that Ho is the first U.S. official that we know who has resigned in protest over the Afghan war.
Well,
what has been the reaction to Ho's letter of resignation?
Well, it was a lead story in the Washington Post, and then it shot around the country and around the internet. So this was a big story, big news. The administration has been trying to control the way the press has been covering the proposed, I put proposed in quotes because it's going to happen, the proposed escalation in the number of troops in Afghanistan. And this is going to hurt them. I think it's only a question of how many troops they're going to send over there, not if, but how many. I think that this could have an influence on what they can get away with.
Michael, I think months ago we did a segment on so-called drones, remote-controlled aircraft. Do you remember that?
Sure.
We heard last week that the United Nations human rights investigator Philip Alston has warned the U.S. government that using drones to target suspected terrorists in Afghanistan and Pakistan can violate international law.
Well, absolutely. It smacks of what criminal prosecutors call a summary execution. And Jane Mayer had an article in The New Yorker 2 weeks ago that between 300 and 500 people have been killed by drones indiscriminately. They can't just target one specific person. They have what they call collateral damage.
In fact, Michael, the BBC reported that drones have killed about 600 people in northwest Pakistan since August 2008. 600.
Yeah. It's a regular occurrence now. Obama has given permission, because it's got to go through him, every week, according to Jane Mayer, every week to use these drones. And what's so particularly horrifying, Heidi, is that these things are controlled out of Nevada by, you know, young kids who are good at video games, and that's the kind of people they recruit, who do these remote-controlled drone summary executions out of Nevada.
Well, speaking of Nevada, Code Pink has been conducting what they call a no-drone campaign at Creech Air Force Base in Las Vegas. We've gotten at the Guild a call to provide some legal support for them because they've engaged in some civil disobedience and hope. They wrote to us that they hope to have a permanent presence there until there are no more drones. So we applaud them for their courageous work out there in Nevada. In 2004, the FBI began to apply intense pressure on Fohad Farahi to become a secret informant and to spy on members of his mosque. Farahi, an imam in Miami, refused. As many listeners may know, an imam is among the designated leaders in a community or mosque who leads prayers during gatherings and helps others to understand the teaching of Islam. The FBI believed that Farahi was in a unique position to know local Muslim men, as he had met several South Floridians with alleged links to terrorism, including Jose Padilla. When Farahi's student visa expired, he applied for political asylum that could allow him to stay in the U.S. indefinitely. More than 2 years after that, in 2007, two agents approached Farahi again about becoming an informant. Once again, he refused. Later that year, his attorney told him at a routine hearing for his political asylum case that an ICE file contained evidence of his involvement in a terrorist case. Farahi was later presented with an ultimatum: to drop the asylum case and leave the U.S. voluntarily, or to be charged as a terrorist. He agreed to leave the country voluntarily, but had to renew his expired passport. During that time, he realized the government was bluffing, and he hired attorney Ira Kurzban, a well-known advocate for immigrants' rights, to represent him. Kurzban asked the Board of Immigration Appeals to throw out Farahi's voluntary departure order, but they refused. The legal battle that has ensued has put Farahi's immigration status in limbo. Kurzban told the Miami Times, quote, "I think the real issue is, does the government have the right to pressure people to make them informants? It's clearly modus operandi of the FBI to recruit people who are going to be informants and to use whatever leverage they can." Attorney Ira Kurzban, a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild and well-known immigration attorney, joins us today. Welcome, Ira, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You are representing Fohad Farahi, who has been approached by the FBI to, in effect, become an informant. Can you give us a brief history of how this happened?
Yes, I think the FBI approached Fohad a number of years back and asked him to cooperate with them. And his response was, I think, the response that anyone would give, which is, as an imam in his mosque, he did not feel he could become an informant for the U.S. government because it would compromise all the worshipers in the mosque, but that he was certainly willing to help the government in any legitimate way he could. The next thing that happened after that was he was put in removal proceedings, what we used to call deportation proceedings, we now call removal proceedings. And it was obviously designed to put some pressure on him. That pressure escalated at the time of his hearing, when FBI agents came to his hearing and basically said to him that if he insisted on claiming political asylum, they would make sure that he's taken into custody and kept in custody. So they were really kind of posing what we would call an unconstitutional condition, which is, unless you voluntarily give up your, quote, voluntarily give up your rights and leave the United States, we're going to make sure that you stay in custody as long as we can place you in jail.
And they were about to send him to Iran, isn't that right?
That's correct. And, you know, of course, he's really never been in Iran. He's an Iranian citizen, but grew up in another country. He is not a Shiite. He would have additional problems, not only that, but having lived in the United States for a substantial period of time, you know, he was truly afraid of going back there at this point.
Now, Ira, I read that the government said it had a file with evidence showing that he was involved with the terrorist case. And I think one of the cases was related to Jose Padilla. Was that not true?
I think it's not true in the way that it was presented. That is, Padilla may have been at the mosque on one or two occasions, but, you know, this is, again, the almost McCarthy-esque guilt by association, simply because somebody's in one place with another person at the same time. Obviously, there are people come in and out of the mosque. It's as if someone shows up at a church or a synagogue who later turns out to be a bad person. It's almost like saying if Bernie Madoff went to a synagogue that the rabbi was responsible for his conduct. The guilt by association method that the FBI has been using as an intimidation tactic is very reminiscent of the McCarthy period.
How long have you been representing him?
I began representing him after all these events occurred, where the government basically forced him into giving up his right to political asylum. He had a lawyer at the time. After that, I think he realized what had happened in terms of his giving up his rights after he came and spoke with us. And we immediately began representing him and demanded that the voluntary departure be withdrawn and that he be allowed to seek political asylum in the United States.
Where does the case stand now, Ira?
The judge who held the original hearing denied our request to reopen the case. That judge was subsequently, by the way, dismissed, I think in part, because he was one of the judges appointed out of the Bush White House instead of being appointed through the normal civil service process. We then appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals. They affirmed the judge's decision. The board, I might add, was purged of many of its liberal members a number of years ago during the Ashcroft administration in the Justice Department. And now we're at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and an oral argument has been set in January of 2010.
Ira, is there a website that you have or a way that our listeners could get in contact, any kind of defense committee, some way that people could show support for Fouad?
Well, I think Fouad has a website. We don't have one, although I would urge people who are interested in these kinds of immigration issues to go to immigrants with an S list.org, which is a political action committee that was started. It's the first pro-immigration political action committee. We have many stories like Fouad's and others on that website.
Give us that website one more time.
Immigrants with an S list, one word.
Immigrants list.
.org. This was the first pro-immigration political action committee set up in the United States. It was set up about 3 years ago, and there are a number of different stories about many different immigration issues. And this is one of them.
Ira, is there anything else that we should know about this case right now?
The most interesting part about this case is that apparently it represents a much broader pattern of conduct by the FBI and the government in trying to intimidate people into working as informants who are from the Middle East. And if the government is unsuccessful trying to find a way to kick them out of the country, pressure them to leave the United States. So Fouad's case, in many respects, is symbolic of a practice that is far more widespread and occurring across the country. And, you know, we've heard, particularly after representing him, we've heard a number of these kinds of stories where the FBI has shown up, demanded that people be informants. When they determined that they were not going to be informants, they started to put either criminal pressure on them, that is, threatening them with criminal proceedings or beginning deportation proceedings as they did in Fouad's case. In fact, we have another case looking at right now. A person in a similar situation was asked to be an informant by the government, declined to do so, but said again that he would certainly, as a person living in the community, this is a person who's a resident, would be more than willing to report anything that he saw or heard in the defense of the United States. That apparently was not good enough, and the government is trying to build a criminal case against him and using his naturalization applications as a method of doing that.
You know, it's just so totally outrageous and racist, I would say, in pointing fingers at American Muslims for something that happened 8 years ago. 15 out of the 19 people that were involved in the airplane bombing of the World Trade Center were from Saudi Arabia. It's just nuts to have this kind of fear campaign where they go around and they do this to people inside the United States that had no connection with anything like this.
And that's why, you know, I think it is very reminiscent of the McCarthy period, where there's somewhat of an hysteria about it. They're not looking at subtle or not so subtle differences between people coming from the Middle East. They're not looking at people who are willing to cooperate and help the United States government versus in fighting terrorism, versus just a blanket. If you're from the Middle East, either you're an informant or you're an enemy, and therefore you have to leave the country. And I suspect that this is far more widespread, just based on the few instances that we know about, where we've heard the FBI is using these kind of pressure tactics. I think they're desperate to get informants, but the bottom line is they're using, you know, upstanding citizens to try and do bad things, you know, whether it's spying on other people and so forth, where there's no basis to do it. The real tragedy here is you're taking people who are solid citizens in one way or another. I mean, in one case we're dealing with an imam, in another we're dealing with a lawful permanent resident who is a successful business person, and the government is using this tactic as a way of really turning people who are friendly to the United States into enemies.
So true. Ira, he is in good hands, and it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. We look forward to hearing about developments in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
On the recent 8th anniversary of the events of September 11, our own Michael Smith draws a balance sheet on the state of democratic rights in America. He spoke to a captive audience at the long-standing Five Towns Forum on Long Island in honor of recently deceased Center for Constitutional Rights Vice President Bob Boehm. Let's have a listen.
The Center for Constitutional Rights recently made an assessment of where we're at. A lot of this is in the literature we put out, which I hope you'll take. But I wanted to just quote a couple lines from their assessment as a beginning of our evaluation. The center said, "The Obama administration," so quote, "has failed to live up to its promises in many areas of critical importance, including human rights, torture, rendition, secrecy, and surveillance." It went further, indicating that in its first 100 days, the Obama administration has not lived up to its promises of hope and change and has not taken concrete action to free the United States, its people, and the world of the attacks on civil liberties and other human rights over the last 8 years and beyond, and to restore the Constitution and the freedoms and rights it promises. And the report of the Center concluded that the future will judge the Obama administration based on how it handles these challenges. The president must initiate a significant rollback of executive power, far greater than that so far embraced by the administration. And it should hold high-level Bush administration officials accountable. Okay. My own view, now that we have 9 months to look back, is that there is going to be no swinging of the pendulum back to where we were before 9/11. I had a client who's the managing editor of the New York Times, and you know, these people meet with presidential aspirants in the editorial room of the Times. They come up and they talk to them. And we went out for a pizza one afternoon. We were going to go look at the scene of the accident. And as an icebreaker, she said to me, hopefully, "So, you're voting for Obama?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Not McCain." And I said, "No." And I said, "You know, do you think," and you know, most of my friends did vote for Obama, you know, very skeptically, but you know, for obvious reasons. But, you know, I can understand why you'd want to have a black person in a White House that slaves built. That's understandable. But I just, you know, I just couldn't do it. And I said to her, "Do you think that when Obama is elected, there's going to be much change and all the democratic rights that have been rolled back? And she said, unhesitatingly, no. So I don't think the pendulum is going to swing back much. There have been some things, and we'll go over that, but it's not going to swing back. There's been a qualitative change in the law. And what was once our democratic rights, there's been nothing less than an undermining of the juridical underpinnings of our democracy. We don't no longer have the democracy we had before 9/11. And, you know, I know you won't accuse me of being overly glowing about the democracy we had before 9/11. It had some obvious limitations. One was class and privilege. Another was, you know, only two parties that really can't reflect what we all are interested in. There's two parties of business, more or less. I mean, I understand those limitations. But nonetheless, we had rights under the First Amendment, the Fourth, the Fifth, the Sixth, speech, assembly, privacy, due process, guarantees against cruel and inhuman treatment, the right to a lawyer, habeas corpus. You know, we had all of that. That disappeared. You know, I co-host this radio show with Michael Ratner from the Center, Heidi Boghossian from the National Lawyers Guild. And we had Daniel Ellsberg on as a guest right before the elections. Now, Ellsberg was a very brave and very smart man. And he said it, and it was just penetrating, and I'll never forget when he said, you know, he said, there's something like a coup that's taken place in this country. That may be an over-exaggeration, but that was the word he used. And he said that that coup has already taken place. Well, what did he mean by this, and what have they accomplished? I think the best explanation, and I apologize for reading these few sentences to you, but I want to be absolutely precise in what I'm trying to articulate, because I think it was captured best by a Belgian scholar named Jean-Claude Pay in a Monthly Review article back in November of 07. And Pay writes the following about the introduction of military law into domestic law, which is what they've done. The government's view is that the attacks of September 11th were an act of war, not just a crime. This view is based on a congressional resolution of September 18th, 2001, a week after. The authorization for the use of military force. They put that through Congress a week after. It still exists. That's why they can go into Afghanistan. The authorization of the use of military force, which grants special powers to the executive branch. It stipulates, quote, that the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Okay, a declaration of war against persons and organizations. The interpretation that the executive makes of this resolution is the expression of a state at war, not against other nations, but against organizations or ordinary individuals that are not linked to a foreign government. This interpretation redefines the concept of war. It gives it an asymmetrical character, a fight to the death between the world superpower and persons designated as enemies. This new concept of war is freed from positing the existence of any real threat against the United States. It is a pure product of the subjectivity of the ruling power. The state of war exists through its proclamation. In the name of the struggle of good against evil, the U.S. state denies the political character of its action. And by blurring the distinction between enemy and criminal, it merges external sovereignty and internal sovereignty. So that's why they can go everywhere they want to go, put people in offshore prison camps. They've kind of expanded globally and lawlessly using that authorization for the use of military force. Well, 3 months later, military order number one was proclaimed by Bush, the commander-in-chief. And this was the coup, in quotes. And Michael Ratner had this to say about military order number one, which is still in effect. And Michael writes, I remember thinking to myself that there's just been a coup d'etat in America. Perhaps an exaggeration, but nonetheless a watershed moment in a country that I still thought had some semblance of a democracy and of the principle that presidential authority was under law. As most of you may not recall the order, let me remind you of its three key provisions. First, the president claimed the authority to capture, kidnap, or otherwise arrest any non-citizen. And it was later extended to citizen. Anywhere in the world, including the United States, whom the president believed was involved in international terrorism and hold them forever without any charges. That wipes out habeas corpus. Proceedings or trial. Amazing. A person could be held forever just because the president wanted them so held. He took on the power to disappear people. Second, the order did provide that if, and if is the crucial word here, if the person was tried, there never need be a trial, but if the person was tried, such trials were to be held by special ad hoc courts called military commissions. There's something inherently flawed by a court that's a military commission because the commander-in-chief runs it. He's the commander-in-chief. So a trial like that is inherently tainted. Clemenceau said about military justice that military justice is to justice as military music is to music. And they now have a law setting up military commissions that Obama supports, and that's what they want to use. They have a choice. They can use a regular trial, they can use a military commission, or they can do nothing and just keep somebody in preventive detention forever. That's the three choices they have now. These commissions had no resemblance to regular trial courts. The entire proceeding could take place in secret with evidence from torture, and those found guilty could be executed in secret. Third, to the extent the names of those persons who were in prison could be determined and lawyers found, no court could hear any case. That's habeas corpus. This order embodies within it the violations of fundamental rights we are facing today. Indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo, secret sites, special trials, and disappearances. While it does not mention torture, that appears to have come a bit later, a secret detention system is part and parcel of a torture system. Let's also repeat, this was a military order in a society and country that was still or purported to be under civilian rule. This order, more than any other single document, embodies our lost liberties. It was this document that pushed the Center for Constitutional Rights into action. That was military order number one. It still exists. Well, what are some of the elements of this, quote, coup? Or maybe a more accurate description would be a rolling coup, because it rolled out. It initially started with the initial seizure of the presidency by stopping the vote count in Florida. Then the doctrine of global superiority and the advocacy of preventive war. The war against Iraq was what they called a preventive war. That has no place in international law. And that's the same thing that's going on now in Afghanistan. And it might go on in Iran. Repudiation of treaties, such as the ABM Treaty. Refusal to recognize international law or the applicability of the Geneva Accords. To his credit, Obama has issued a proclamation saying they now respect the Geneva Accords. The roundup of immigrants after 9/11, people held without charges for months and months. Domestic deployment of the military as law enforcement, like they did in New Orleans after Katrina. That's illegal under the Posse Comitatus Act of 1876. That's absolutely illegal, but they're using the military domestically. That's very dangerous for obvious reasons. Establishment of military tribunals and Guantanamo. Well, to his credit, Obama said, Bush said it before him actually, because it was such a black eye for the United States that both of them want to close Guantanamo, but they haven't done it yet. Secret deportation hearings, I don't think those are going on anymore. seizure of citizens as enemy combatants, including American citizens, massive secret wiretaps in violation of the FISA law, under the Patriot Act, they now do all this. Obama absented himself when they had the vote on that. Issuance of secret administrative warrants for all kinds of records. Well, that's under the Patriot Act. That's still going on. And if you get a subpoena asking you for records on so-and-so, you can't tell anybody you got the subpoena, because that's against the law. Suppression of Muslim charities. They wiped off the biggest Muslim charity. Secret sneak and peek searches. That's under the Patriot Act. That's still going on. And again, you can't tell anybody. Classification of most government records. Reversal of the idea that government should be transparent, but people's personal lives kept private. Well, to his credit, Obama has issued an order that, Ashcroft said, we won in the 60s. We won the FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act. It was one of the things we won after Watergate. The theory that the government is our government, and therefore these documents that the government has really are documents, and they ask for them, we should get them. I'm sure a lot of you got your FBI files. Ashcroft said, don't honor any of these requests anymore. And if they fight you, we'll back you up. And Obama reversed that. Legitimation of torture. Very, very sadly, Obama using that sophistry of we have to look forward, not backward. If you don't prosecute these people, what's the disincentive? They want to do it again, they'll do it again. The only ones they're prosecuting are, like during Abu Ghraib, hillbillies on the night shift, Lindy English and her boyfriend. Their formulation now, this Eric Holder stuff about who they're going to prosecute, is a sham and a diversion. Because who they're prosecuting now is, they came out with rules. So like one of the rules is you could pour 41 degree water on somebody. They shackle them and they strip them naked and they put 41 degree water on them for 20 minutes. And you can do that twice a day. That was one of the things you could do to a prisoner. They studied hypothermia. They read books from Canada, and they figured out how to torture people with cold water. So who are they prosecuting now? If you sprayed water that was 40 degrees, or if you sprayed water for 21 minutes, that guy is going to get prosecuted.
That was Michael Smith speaking at the Five Towns Forum on Long Island. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Earlier this month, federal judge Joan A. Leonard reduced the life sentence for Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five. Mr. Guerrero, a United States citizen, was convicted of spying for Cuba while working at the Naval Air Station in Key West, Florida. His sentence was reduced to almost 22 years, which means he could be out of prison in nearly 7 years. Mr. Guerrero's attorneys had asked for a sentence to be reduced to 240 months, which the U.S. government had agreed to. But Judge Leonard set it at 262 months. Mr. Guerrero's lawyer, Len Wineglass, told the New York Times it was an odd decision. He said, quote, "You have a man who was on a military base but who didn't take a single classified document, and no one testified that he injured U.S. national security, but the judge still rejects the prosecutor's request to lighten the sentence." Len Weinglass joins us to tell us more about the decision. Len Weinglass, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Len, you've been defending the Cuban Five for many years. These are men who were merely trying to protect the island against terrorism generated in Miami under the watchful eye of the United States government, which did nothing. I wanted you to give us an update on what's happened. They were sent to prison. You won, and your client, Guerrero, was supposed to be resentenced. You went down for the resentencing. Can you bring us up to date on what happened at the resentencing? What did you argue, and what kind of response did you get from the judge, and how did it go down?
Thanks, Michael. Antonio Guerrero, one of the five who I represent, was originally sentenced to life in prison. That sentence was also given to Ramon Labanino and to Gerardo Hernandez. The appellate courts reversed the life sentence for the charge of conspiracy to commit espionage against the three, but it only remanded for a new sentence as to two, my client Antonio and Ramon. It didn't remand for Gerardo because he was doing a life sentence already on another charge of conspiracy, that one, conspiracy to commit murder. So we returned to Miami on Tuesday, October 13th, for the resentencing of my client, who was then serving life. Prior to the resentencing hearing on that date, we had negotiated with the government on the issue of sentencing alone, making it very clear there was no admission of guilt of the underlying charge, which we are still contesting in a later collateral attack. So on the sentencing issue alone, we agreed with the government that it should come down from life to a period of 20 years. That agreement was then laid before the court during the resentencing hearing in a six-page written agreement signed by both sides, including the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami. And the judge then took the very unusual step of setting the agreement aside and sentencing him against the agreement, not to a term of 20 years, but to a term of 21 years and 10 months, adding in effect 22 more months onto his sentence. Be that as it may, it means that Antonio, who up to that point in time was serving life, and under the federal rules he stays until he dies in a life sentence, will be returned home to Cuba within 7 years. Reciting, in effect, the indictment that this case involved a very serious matter, which was the government's contention 11 years ago, in which Cuban agents, of whom Antonio Guerrero was one, sought out top-secret information. That was her position 11 years ago, and it was that position which got reversed, because the appellate court said to her, you cannot give a person a life sentence on what they intended to get. You can only give a life sentence if they, in fact, got top-secret information, and in this case, there was no top-secret information that was gathered or transmitted back to Cuba. Therefore, the original sentence of life was wrong. But when we got back into the resentencing hearing, she began to restate her original position, as if the appellate court hadn't ruled that you can't do this. So it was a very tense moment, and it looked like the judge was going to revert back to a life sentence.
Well, I think that got your juices flowing, didn't it, Len? What did you tell the judge?
Well, I got very upset with that. The courtroom was packed with the same old crowd, the crowd in Miami that backs these paramilitary forces. They, of course, put the widows of the shoot-down up front in the front row, and then the rest of the crowd, they look like they are themselves either mercenaries or ex-mercenaries. A lot of them are older. They sat there, and the judge was addressing that crowd. I got very upset with what I saw to be the climate that was being generated in that hearing. And so I reminded the judge very forcefully that she was sentencing an individual, not a country. and that's what the rules require. I had previously provided to the government and to the judge a series of documents in a booklet form, all of them government documents, all of them from the Bureau of Prisons, all of them saying that Antonio Guerrero, who was serving a faulty life sentence, which he never should have gotten, and was assigned to a maximum security prison where he never should have been sent because the sentence was wrong, nonetheless did 7 years in that prison, and the warden and the supervisor of the unit and his counselor all extolled his behavior and most significantly pointed out that he had helped save a number of inmates, all of whom were doing life sentences, from an incorrigible future by training them in English and math and overseeing their getting their GEDs. In other words, Antonio was doing what the prison system is supposed to do and doesn't do, that is help rehabilitate inmates. And that had to count for something. That hadn't happened the last time he was before the court for sentencing 8 years earlier. And the judge was dismissing it. It made me quite angry. And I tried to remind her that you're not sentencing Cuba, you're sentencing Antonio. And look at this record, and how can you discount it?
And I understand that after you told her that, she walked off the bench.
She called a recess. It was a fairly heated moment in the courtroom, and what judges frequently do when that happens, they flee the courtroom.
Well, you know, it sounded, Lenny, to me like when you told the story to us that you actually may have made the difference between a life sentence and the 22 months, that it sounds conceivable to me that she was ready to give a very long sentence, if not a life sentence, and that you actually so publicly really made it difficult for her to do that she felt she had to go off the bench and reconsider. That's what it sounds like. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I hate to take credit for that because in reality, Michael, there's no way of knowing what the judge was about to do. She was about to pronounce sentence when she stopped. And I don't know what she was about to say or if she was about to say anything. So I can't take credit for that. The interesting thing is, when she came back 40 minutes later onto the bench, the first thing she did is recite a Supreme Court decision. All federal judges must sentence an individual according to his character.
I love it, Lenny.
That was the first thing she said. Yeah. So I breathed a sigh of relief that at least she was acknowledging that much.
But, you know, Len, the government did what it usually does with respect to Cuba. It broke its agreement again.
Yes.
And sending him away for a long, long time, far away in Colorado. The underlying unfairness of this and the fact that it has not been covered in the mainstream press and that they've stolen the lives of five people for only trying to defend their country against terrorism is so ironic that it's just an extraordinary kind of underground story that hasn't been covered, and who knows what's going to happen to it. My only speculation is that this judge, anyway, gave him not the time that you and the government had agreed to, but additional time because she's campaigning to get herself promoted to the Court of Appeals. You don't need to comment on that, but that's my reaction to this injustice.
Yes, I have no way of knowing that, Michael. But, you know, you're right. Antonio was 39 when he was arrested, and he'll be nearly 60 when he's released. And I told this to the judge during the argument. That's the heart of a lifetime. How many people would give up their ages from 39 to 60 in an enterprise that was meant to save lives in Cuba and to prevent a war between the two states? And he did that, and you're right, there's no acknowledgement of context here. There's no acknowledgement that this whole episode was provoked by a pattern of violence directed at Cuba, where over 3,000 people have died over the past 40 years from violence coming from southern Florida. And it was that violence which brought him here in order to infiltrate these groups and to warn Cuba. And since the five came to the United States to infiltrate those groups of mercenaries that exist quite publicly and openly in Florida, there has not been a single episode where property damage has occurred or an individual has been injured. So they performed their task. Nobody in the United States was harmed. No property was damaged. And they end up with life sentences for that operation. But there is, you're right, Michael, no context to this. The federal courts in these areas operate in an Orwellian world where the judge said to us, law has to be respected. And that was her argument. Well, my client respected the law. He entered into a negotiation with the government. He was willing to accept a substantial sentence. And what happened, as you pointed out, with this agreement? The first time it saw the light of day in a courtroom, it was dismissed by the court. Well, what does that say about respect for the law?
Lenny, can you give us an update on what's happening with the other four?
Yes, it's very unclear at this point. We're now 8 days past the sentencing of Antonio, and nothing has been resolved with respect to the other two who were scheduled to be resentenced. There are ongoing arguments and discussions between counsel, but there has been no resentencing date set for them. And I don't know where those cases are going to end up, although I hope and I expect that both of those sentences will come down as well. You know, something happened in Cuba yesterday. I don't think I can say it's directly related to the government agreeing with Antonio that his sentence should be cut short. But yesterday, the Cuban government released one of the dissidents and paroled another.
That's pretty interesting.
Yes. Now, the media is reporting it, and I read Reuters this morning, as a consequence of the visit to Cuba of the foreign minister of Spain. But the Cubans issued no statement relating it to that. But that's how the media views it. Of course, as you all point out, the media is totally unaware of what happened in Miami last Tuesday. So Cuba has taken that step, and I can't say that it's in reaction to what happened with Antonio or not, but it has, in fact, happened.
Len, I saw you at the press conference after the sentencing, and you said that you won't appeal the decision, but you will file an attack on the conviction itself. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's a good question, Heidi, because people think that Antonio came in and pled guilty. That didn't happen at all, and we made that clear right at the outset. He still will be appealing his conviction. What he agreed upon was a reduction in his sentence. And what we intend to do is we intend to file what used to be called the federal habeas and is now referred to as a Section 2255 collateral attack on his conviction. And we have until June of 2010, which is 1 year after the Supreme Court denied the review of his case. The statute gives you up to 1 year to file a collateral attack on your conviction, and we will do that. And that attack is limited. It can only be filed on issues of a constitutional nature that were not previously litigated. For instance, the venue issue that we won initially, only to have it reversed, cannot be again attacked because that has already been litigated. But there are other issues. To give you an example, it came to light after our case was appealed that the federal government was paying members of the press in Miami as part of their anti-Castro government campaign to write articles. And articles written about this case that were highly prejudicial by people who were reporters but were on the federal payroll. Now the question is, can the government be responsible for creating a prejudicial atmosphere by paying reporters to write anti-Castro materials and at the same time defend against a change of venue?
Wait, I don't understand. You're saying the government paid reporters?
Yes. They were being paid out of the funds for Radio Marti to write materials that were broadcast on Radio Marti that were propaganda against the Cuban government. But at the same time, they were reporters for other legitimate media, so-called legitimate media, like the Miami Herald. And these were the reporters who were writing highly prejudicial materials on the case.
It's amazing, Lenny. That's just amazing.
It's just amazing.
What do you say?
I mean, I remember in the old Cold War days, so the big attack against, say, the Soviet Union was that their journalists were not objective, that they were on the payroll of the government, you know, and this violated all kinds of notions of human liberty. They've now managed to overthrow the government of the Soviet Union. They're borrowing the same tactics. It's just extraordinary that happened.
We're finding out through the Freedom of Information Act. We have it clear on several of them, but we're probing it even deeper, and we hope to get that information more complete by June of 2010, so we'll have a basis for argument. There are other issues as well that we're going to be filing on, particularly issues that go to the conviction of Gerardo Hernandez, who is serving a double life sentence and who should not be in that position at all. But we will be unearthing information about what brought about his conviction as well.
Len, if people want to support the Cuban Five, do you have a website that we can recommend them to go to?
Yes, there's a Free the Five website on the Internet. That's one. And I think there are links to others as well. But that's the principal one. That one, by the way, has put up in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 days, very beautiful poem written by Antonio, who is a poet, my client. He's also an artist.
We're going to read the third stanza, Lenny, and then maybe you can give us a reaction to it.
Okay.
Once again, orange jumper. Once again, solitude between bricks. Once again, broken mattress without pillow. Once again, big noise in the hall. Once again, to change clothes once a week. Once again, a tiny yellow pencil. Once again, by a miracle, a phone call. Once again, to walk without destiny. Once again, a cage to recreate. This time, even they don't give coffee. Once again, dirty floor, cold shower. Once again, a cop-out to complain. And of course, they don't answer once again. Once again, whole. And once again, poetry.
Yes, that's beautiful. That is Antonio. That's exactly as I know him, and as anyone who's come across him knows him. I mean, he was at the most hard-nosed prison in the United States, and after 7 years, the warden of the prison wrote the Regional Bureau of Prisons asking that Antonio be released from that institution because he doesn't deserve to be there. For me, that's practically unprecedented. But that's Antonio, and that's the way he is. He is a poet in his soul, and he helping people is a major part of his character. He's just a lovely, sensitive man.
Len, just as a reminder, if listeners do not recall, this government has been especially punitive in not allowing the families to visit.
That's true. With respect to two of the five, Rene Gonzalez and Gerardo Hernandez, their wives have not been given visas so they could travel from Cuba to the United States to see their husbands. That's been true for more than 10 years.
Well, it's a somber note on which to end, Len. Thank you for giving us an update on this case, and we look forward to hearing about preparations for the next filing in 2010.
Yes, thanks, Heidi, and thank you all for having me.
Thank you, Len.
Bye, Len.
Yeah. So long, Len.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours. better working conditions. Vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter'll be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting, talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of blind men's cups. You got a union now and you're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen when one guy squawks, but he's got to listen when the union talks. He'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose they're working you so hard it's just outrageous and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, because he thinks he's got your union licked. Well, he looks out the window and what does he see but 1,000 pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair! Slave driver. Bet he beats his wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard. They'll tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting. They'll hit you on the head. They'll call every one of you a damn red unpatriotic. Japanese spies. Sabotaging national defense. But out at Ford, here's what they found, and out at Vulti, here's what they found, and out at Alice Chalmers, here's what they found, and down at Bethlehem, here's what they found, that if you don't let red baiting break you up, and if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, and if you don't let vigilantes break you up, and if you don't let race hatred break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.